DW Deutsche Welle. World Link.
Hello and welcome to this edition of DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Emma Wallace. On this week's show, fear and trepidation are being felt on both sides of the divide between Israel and Gaza as the conflict intensifies.
If we could leave, I'd either go back to upstate New York, or I'd probably go, you're going to laugh, to Texas, because I would need to be back around a Jewish community, but I'd need to be somewhere that's still accepting of Israel.
We'll also be hearing how Iraq has now been divided de facto into three states and what that could mean for the rest of the region. And the woman who has worn purple every day since 2012.
These stories and more coming up on Worldlink.
You're listening to DW's World Link. I'm Neil King.
And I'm Emma Wallace. The sound of the first Israeli troops entering Gaza on Thursday night. Last-ditch attempts by the Egyptians to secure a full ceasefire between Israel and Hamas have failed this week, and the Israelis on Friday launched a broad ground offensive in Gaza to try, in Israeli words, restore peace.
Dozens of UN schools and more than 20 health buildings have been damaged in the ongoing offensive against Gaza by the Israelis. Children and civilians have died in the crossfire in Gaza, and more than 250 Palestinian lives lost so far since the start of this conflict. But everyone on both sides live in fear of rockets and bombs landing on their houses, and many Israelis spend nights and days in special bomb shelters in their gardens. Living under constant threat of attack is making them nervous and is even causing some to question their faith in the wisdom of Zionism. Kate Shuttleworth reports from Jerusalem.
When residents in Jerusalem hear this, they know they must rush to bomb shelters too. Despite being a partially divided city, which is never far away from the tensions of this region, not everyone in Jerusalem is used to this. Some are debating whether they should leave Israel entirely over the 1,400 rockets that have been fired in the past 2 weeks. It's almost midday in one of the busiest parts of Jerusalem, in the main market, or Shuk Mahane Yehuda. The smell of spices fills the air, and bright ripe fruits pop out at you as you walk through the two parts of the market, open air and closed. It's a world away from the devastation in the Gaza Strip, where shops are boarded up and markets closed. In southern Israel too, where rocket fire is the most intense, and code red sirens urging people into bomb shelters are more regular. This is Ariella Aharon, a 22-year-old Jewish American from Pennsylvania, who is part of the Orthodox Chabad movement. She has made Jerusalem her home and is passionate about it. She's not afraid to be here or stay here, but despite this, she knows approximately how long it would take for a rocket fired from Gaza to reach Jerusalem.
It's in Jerusalem at 60 to 90 seconds. It's a lot more time than they have. Like in the south in Sderot, they have 15 seconds, which is unreal.
Ariella is thinking ahead and has estimated where she can feasibly run in that time for shelter in the market when a warning siren goes off.
There are always people, there are Israelis who would just keep doing whatever they're doing and ignore the siren, which is pretty silly, but there are. So last time when the first siren went off, I was at the grocery store and I didn't even hear it.
In Gaza, more than 200 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes. But militants in Gaza have widened their arsenal too, to include longer-range missiles, able to reach further north in Israel than ever before. Ariella says increased rocket fire isn't the new normal for Jerusalem, as the conflict is not new.
Terrorism, it's a constant in Israeli life ever since, you know, like the establishment of the state. So I think that it's not a deterrent anymore.
Ariella says in some ways it's easier to be in Israel than to leave, but her family in the US are still worried about her choosing to stay in Israel.
I definitely did get a lot of pressure to come home. My mother offered to pay for my ticket. You know, my siblings, You know, were sending me messages, calling me on the phone. You know, a lot of them, I had them download the Red Alert app. It's easier to be here than it is to be somewhere else kind of watching the news. What they're showing on the news, I'm not experiencing it really now.
Ariella says her ideology as a religious Jew keeps her in Israel amid rising tensions, and she's adamant she will not leave.
Just because I'm like a Zionist, I feel like it's like acquiescing to like terrorism, you know, it's giving in, and I think that it's the wrong thing to do, to give in and to let that, you know, let that terror get to you, to like let them succeed. That's what they want to do. They want to drive us out of Israel.
I'm on Bethlehem Road, which is just near the German colony, and I've come up to a news agent. And just on the newsstand right here is a copy of the Jerusalem Post in English and also one newspaper in Hebrew. So I'm picking up the Jerusalem Post, and the headlines on the main page today are Israel agrees to 5-hour humanitarian ceasefire, Cabinet authorizes call-up of 8,000 more reservists, and even if Israel is burning, we will be there. Hundreds of French immigrants arrived despite the operation in Gaza. So I'm just going to go inside and see if someone can tell me what this Hebrew newspaper says.
Okay, it says in the headlines, it says that the big test is, will Hamas respect the ceasefire in the morning?
And can you just tell me this picture of children here, what is this all?
This is an actual live picture at a kindergarten, like a camp for kids in summer, where they got the siren to tell them a missile might be falling, and they're taught to lie down. It was too quick for them to get to the protected shelter.
And that's in the south of Israel.
They're taught to lie down and cover their heads.
The tension has even infiltrated the leafy green Jerusalem suburb of Talpiot, where one Jewish American mother is seriously considering her family's future in Israel. 29-year-old Sarah Grossman is due to give birth next week, and she says if money wasn't an object, she would be booking a ticket for herself, her partner, and her 6-year-old daughter to leave Israel right now. When she came to Israel as a young single woman, she had a strong sense of Zionist patriotism. She was a practicing Orthodox Jew at the time, but has since become more secular. Now that she's a mother, she feels that her sense of Zionism is not worth turning her children into martyrs for. Seeing the fear on her daughter's face each time a code red siren is sounded has made her want to leave.
For me, any idealistic anything, any view, any political, any religious concept, I don't think is worth the lives of your children. And I don't think fighting for Israel or for the U.S. or for Judaism or anything is worth their lives. And my daughter is really afraid for her life, and she's really afraid for the life of her family, and she's six. There's a limit to how much she really understands, but she knows that the siren's bad, and she knows that it's scary. She also knows what the Holocaust is.
That code red siren, which scares Sarah's daughter, is used to warn against rocket fire from Hamas militants. But it is also the same siren sounded every year for Holocaust Remembrance Day, so the sound sends shivers down everyone's spines.
When you hear the siren, what you think of is the camps, and you think of the mounds of bodies, and you think of the mothers sheltering their children from being shot, and you think of every horrible image you could ever imagine. And so you hear that siren, that's what you think about. That's what you think about happening. There is a sort of subconscious fear of that happening again, of the Holocaust happening again, Israel being wiped out, the implications.
For now, Sarah says she has to stay because she's about to give birth, but she's still looking for an exit plan once her son is born in the coming weeks.
If we could leave, I'd either probably go back to upstate New York, or I'd probably go, you're going to laugh, to Texas, because I would need to be back around a Jewish community, but I'd need to be somewhere that's still accepting of Israel and Judaism.
As Sarah contemplates her family's next move, Israel remains a divided nation between those who, like Sarah, would leave in a heartbeat, And those who, like Ariella, will stay through thick and thin, even though their patience is tested at every turn.
Kate Shuttleworth sent us that report from Jerusalem.
It's now been over a month since the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, took over swathes of Iraqi territory. The Iraqi army has so far been unable to reclaim the land ISIS has occupied. They have concentrated their battles on key towns, but the militants remain strong and have declared their own Islamic caliphate. So is Iraq now a failed state? And what could this mean for the rest of the region if the situation is allowed to continue? Rebecca Collard reports.
مؤسسة الفرقان للإنتاج الإعلامي تقدم رسالة إلى المجاهدين والأمة الإسلامية.
When the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria declared its caliphate, the threat to Iraq's sovereignty became clearer than ever. Claiming a territory stretching through Iraq and Syria, the extremist Sunni militants renamed themselves just the Islamic State and said it was now Islamic law that rules. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was announced the leader, the caliph of the new territory. Eventually, he surfaced in the Iraqi city of Mosul.
إن الحمد لله نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله من
He, Allah, has enabled us to achieve our aims. After years of battling the enemies of Allah, we have now installed our caliphate and chosen an imam.
Speaking in a large ornate mosque in Mosul, the enemies he refers to are the sovereign states of Iraq and Syria. And in the case of Iraq, that battle was with the American-trained and equipped National Army. The fact that a man wanted by both Iraq and Syria allegedly crossed the country's shared border shows how little control the government in Baghdad now has. Most in Iraq blame Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and his Shia-led government. He has resisted stepping aside, and the new parliament has struggled to come to a compromise that would allow the formation of a new Iraqi government. Haval Karim is a 28-year-old pharmacist, and like many here, he's quick to say al-Maliki must go.
I think that the end of al-Maliki, it will be soon, inshallah. He don't want to solve the problems. Just he thinks about Shia and Iran and Hezbollah and Syria. Don't think about what will happen if he do not solve the problems politically. He's just about think about the force. So this is very wrong for someone prime minister think about like that.
Instead of efforts and compromise in the political sphere, Prime Minister al-Maliki and his government have been touting the strength of the disgraced Iraqi army. National television shows almost constant images of the Iraqi army training and staging battles in the Iraqi desert. The announcer here vows to crush the terrorists. But so far, the government has had no such luck. It continues to battle militants for key cities. For many here, the end of Iraq is a foregone conclusion, and one that some in the country are looking forward to. Many Sunnis, and especially Kurds, are looking for independence now, not a new deal with Baghdad.
He want to fight us. If he can, he will fight us. He will fight Kurdish people like Saddam, like some terrorist people. But he cannot do anything with Kurdish people because we have good economy right now. We have oil, we have everything. So we will do referendum and we will get the country here.
Hoshang Assad wheels his car through the streets of Erbil, the Kurdish de facto capital. After decades of struggle for sovereignty, it seems the instability caused by the Islamic State is bringing Kurds closer than ever to independence. And he says it's not just the Kurds that will get their own state.
It will be three countries in Iraq. Shia, as I told you, Sunni, and Kurdish country. Very soon. Yeah, that's better, sure. It's better. For everybody from Iraq. For everyone.
But foreign powers and the international community, not to mention Baghdad, are unlikely to agree with him. The U.S. has poured money and American lives into the preservation of Iraq and won't be keen to see the country dissolve. The idea of splitting up Iraq is inherently uncomfortable for many, neighboring states like Turkey and Iran, with large Kurdish minorities, and others like Syria, with Sunni uprisings of their own, won't want to see a state-splitting example. The bigger fear is that Iraq, with his sectarian divisions, has shown how easily an Islamic insurgency can find success in a weak state. From Syria to the Gaza Strip, these Islamic movements are challenging nation-states, and if this Islamic State is able to maintain control here and win the hearts of the local population, they will look to expand even further, putting the whole region at risk and perhaps lighting the final touch paper, which could escalate tensions to a dangerous level.
Rebecca Collard in Erbil, reporting from Iraq there.
Earlier this week, the Church of England's General Synod held an historic vote. For the first time in its history, it backed the idea of allowing women to become bishops. In 2012, the same vote was blocked by traditionalist lay members, even though the idea had been backed by the houses of bishops and clergy. This time, though, it gained the required two-thirds majority. All this will be good news for many of the women who are already clergy in the Church of England, and not least for Philippa Boardman, canon at St Paul's Cathedral in the heart of London. Since that vote in 2012, she's been instigating a personal rebellion by wearing purple, the colour reserved for bishops in the church every day. So, is she still wearing purple?
I have to say I'm not, because I think we've now really feel kind of liberated that women are able to serve God in every aspect of the Church of England and the Church's life. So, no, dispensed with the purple.
How did you experience Monday's vote? It must have been an amazing feeling.
It was, as you might know, that it was quite a close vote leading up to it, because the vote had been voted down in November 2012. So we were very uncertain about how it was going to go. So there was quite a lot of kind of anticipation beforehand. And then when the Archbishop of York slowly and carefully read out the results, you know, we all had our kind of hearts in our mouths. And then there was a great, yeah, that feeling of relief, but also that sense of liberation that there's going to be a new start for women in the Church of England.
So completely different feelings to the vote in 2012 when the move was rejected. How painful was that experience for you in 2012 when women were barred from becoming bishops? Did you consider leaving the church because of it?
I didn't consider leaving the church, but it did leave me in a very difficult position. I've been ordained over 20 years now, and I've always been very proud almost to wear a clergy shirt and what we is nicknamed, you know, the dog collar. And I've always had very good conversations with members of the general public when I've been out and about, you know, wearing clerical garb. But that night after the vote, you know, was the first time when I actually kind of tied a scarf around my neck so that the clerical collar couldn't be seen, because I just felt so awkward to be out in public wearing that collar, which was, I think, a sign at that point, which I felt didn't affirm women as equal in the sight of God.
Philippa, what made you want to become a clergywoman in the first place, given that women weren't all that welcome back then?
I suppose it was a couple of things. First of all, that was back in the 1980s, and the Church of England was very outward-looking at that time. There was something called the Faith in the City report, where the church held a commission which went all over the urban areas of England, talking with people in areas of poverty and unemployment and struggle, and really engaging with that agenda. And that was very exciting to me as a young person, that the Church of England was very outward-looking. And I also had a kind of a personal experience of faith, where I felt a huge amount of peace in my life. And so those two things, the personal and the engagement with the community and the world, was very inspiring for me at that time.
Can you perhaps elaborate a bit more on that personal experience that brought you to the faith?
Yes, I think as perhaps many teenagers go through the experience of having a lot of questions about themselves, about their personal sense of worth and their calling in life, and how others see them. And I was quite an anxious and stressed teenager, and I then encountered people who were committed Christians and gradually heard more about the Christian faith, and then decided when I was 17 years old to take that step for myself, and just felt a huge amount of peace in my life, and a sense of being kind of affirmed as a precious child of God. And that made a huge difference to me at that time and has ever since. And that's a message I, you know, want to share with everyone I meet.
Apart from the faith itself, did you also join the church, perhaps not at 17, I don't know, but maybe a little bit later on, also wanting to work within it to change it and bring more equality for women?
I've always felt this is a very important agenda, because when people come into churches, I think it's vital that they see both men and women, people of different ethnic backgrounds, people with various abilities, disabilities, are serving God as an affirmation that everyone is that precious child of God, and everyone can serve God in whatever way they are gifted to do so.
Did you ever face any hostility from your flock or colleagues over your gender?
I think there were, you know, one or two perhaps awkward moments where perhaps a family who were seeking somebody, a minister, to take a funeral and weren't quite sure. This is in the early days, about a woman taking the funeral. But the person who, my vicar at that time, when I was a kind of a young curate, he would say, just go and meet the family and see them and talk to them. And I think on every single occasion where a family had expressed some concern, once we'd actually met face to face and started talking together, and they had begun to share, you know, their sense of loss and what their hopes were for creating a really beautiful and dignified funeral service for their loved one, then we began to overcome any fears or concerns that they might have had.
Do you think women bring something different to the church?
I think perhaps in this first generation of women priests, and thank goodness soon to be women bishops, we perhaps sometimes come in with a sense of having been on the margins of church life. So perhaps we have a particular concern for those who are also on the margins and trying to bring them in. But I think it's very important that we don't kind of go down the road of thinking that women have particular gifts and men have particular gifts, because I think God gives gifts liberally and regardless of gender or ability or sexual orientation, you know, to a wide variety of people. And so I wouldn't necessarily want to be too prescriptive about women bringing particular things.
Looking ahead, Philippa, what impact will this vote have on the church and your flock around the world, do you think?
Well, at St Paul's Cathedral, where I work now, we had an event on Wednesday night, just 2 days after the vote, called Women in Leadership, where we brought together a panel, a woman, a leader from the business community, a woman from a campaigning organisation, also Frances O'Grady, the first ever woman to be General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress. And we had over 1,400 people came to that event. Many young women came. And that was so exciting, that young women were coming into the cathedral. And I hope that this is a positive sign that the church has taken this vote on women bishops, that it's a positive sign to young women that there is a future in the church, and that they are very affirmed in the church looking to the future.
We started this interview talking about whether you're still wearing purple, because you were donning it every day since 2012 as a sign of rebellion. But how about putting the purple back on as England's first female bishop?
I think that's always a very tough question to answer. There are very many talented and gifted women who could be bishops in the Church of England. And so I think it's a matter of seeing where the jobs are, what the gifts are that are particularly needed in that diocese to take that diocese forward in leadership. And I shall certainly be cheering on whoever the first women bishops are and praying for them.
Is it something you would like to do?
Again, I think it is a very tough one, because I think whoever the first women bishops are, they will be under a lot of scrutiny. So I don't think it's a particularly enviable task. But seriously, I will be, you know, very much in 100% support of whoever they are when they are first appointed and begin those ministries.
Philippa Boardman, Canon of St Paul's Cathedral in London, speaking to us there. You're listening to DW's Worldlink, where I'm Neil King.
And I'm Emma Wallace. This is DW's WorldLink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Emma Wallace.
And I'm Neil King.
In this second half of the show, family is a theme which runs through many of our reports. There's a man looking for his lost son in North Waziristan. He's one of more than 800,000 people who have been internally displaced due to Pakistani military operations against the Taliban.
Plus, Kurdish families are also looking for their children, who they allege have been stolen by the PKK.
And the woman who was inspired by her father to rediscover her heritage in Bangladesh.
I was presented to a society, looking back, it's almost like Jane Austen land without the fun, without any of the dances, and it's a very orthodox community.
All this coming up in the next half hour.
Last month, the Pakistani government ordered villagers in an area of North Waziristan to vacate the area to allow them to launch a large military operation against the Taliban and its militant groups. Shireen Jan was one of those who had spent 7 decades living in the area and was being turfed out.
The military operation, which is still ongoing, resulted in a mass exodus of internally displaced peoples, or IDPs, from this area into the other parts of the country. According to the latest official figures, over 800,000 people have left the areas in which the Pakistani military has launched its offensive against the Taliban. Malik Ayub Sumbal sent us this report from Pakistan. The report is voiced by Andre Leslie.
These are the sounds of the Pakistani army's military incursion into North Waziristan. They consider this area a hub of local and foreign militant groups. Since 9/11, the militants and the jihadists have created sanctuaries in this area, and they have been launching cross-border attacks in Pakistan and Afghanistan ever since. Shireen Jan was a local resident of Sor Palagar in Tehsil Miramshah in North Waziristan, the area that's just been cleared. He feels bitter about the army's offensive, which has turned his life upside down and deprived him of all his belongings.
The government asked us to vacate the area, but we don't have any resources to leave. We can't even afford the fare for the vehicles to move our belongings. I was forced to borrow some money from my neighbors to move my family here to Banu City.
Shireen Jan is forced to sleep out in the open because the authorities have not provided any shelter or accommodation for his family. But he didn't just lose his belongings and house. During the chaotic move from his hometown, his younger son went missing, and he's still searching for him in the IDP camps.
My younger son went missing. We were traveling on foot from Miramshah to Bonn. We needed 20 hours for this one-hour trip because of the blocked roads that were teeming with IDPs.
Shireen Jan's whole family has been worried sick about their missing son, who's just 7 years old. But fortunately, according to Shireen, it looks like they'll be reunited soon.
I just found out that there is a young boy in the army camp, and they discovered him the same time we lost him. So I'm very happy he's been missing for the past 10 days.
Despite all the hardship of being uprooted in the wake of the government's offensive, Jan and his family blame the Taliban for their current predicament.
We're in this situation today because of the Taliban, who've been occupying this area for the past several years. This is all because our people give them shelter here. Otherwise, we would be living in peace in the comfort of our homes.
He'll never forget the day he was forced to leave his village. As the announcements blared over the loudspeakers of the mosques, warning the villagers to leave the area immediately, he was in two minds whether he should comply and desert his animals and home.
Initially, I decided that we won't leave our house. But when all the people and our neighbors started leaving in droves, my children and my family started crying. They were afraid of being killed in the bombing. It was then that I decided to pack up and leave this area.
Shireen Jan is standing in a long queue of IDPs, waiting his turn to get some food and a donation package pledged by the government. But despite joining the queue early each morning, he leaves without anything at the end of the day, because there are thousands of people in the line ahead of him, making it almost impossible to reach the IDP registration desk.
Today is the seventh day I've queued here for the registration and ration card, but it is really hard to get it and wait in these long lines in the blistering sun.
The administration has failed to help all the people in the camp with the necessary supplies because the available resources are dwarfed by the number of IDPs, which is now estimated to be close to 800,000 people. The anger is mounting among the bereft refugees.
They're not giving us the donation package promised by the government. The administration is corrupt, and they're pocketing it themselves. The government has pledged 12,000 rupees for every IDP family.
The government also promised the military offensive would wipe out the militants once and for all. But the locals have a very different take on this. According to Shireen Jan, the Taliban and the foreign militants are still very much at large.
There are no Taliban there now because they left the area before the operation.
Given the militants have simply withdrawn for the time being and were not killed, Shireen Jan is uncertain when he will be able to return to his hometown, not to mention when peace will be restored in the area.
Everything has been destroyed there, and I'm not sure that we will be able to go home in the next couple of years.
Andre Leslie voicing that report by Malik Ayub Sumbul there.
The southeastern part of Turkey is predominantly inhabited by Kurds, a group whose armed wing has long been fighting to establish an independent state, just like their fellow Kurds in Iraq. But in recent months, an increasing number of Kurdish families have been calling for the return of their children.
They claim they were abducted by the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. The PKK has denied any responsibility. But now the Turkish Prime Minister has entered the dispute, and that's putting pressure on an already stalled peace process, as Dorian Jones reports from Diyarbakir.
Under the ancient Diyarbakir city wall, in the sweltering summer heat, a group of families hold a daily vigil for their children, who they claim in the past few months were abducted by the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. Each carries a photograph of their child. Some were as young as 14 years old when they disappeared, like Surya Tokla, whose son disappeared 3 months ago. She says she's convinced her son was kidnapped by the rebel group.
My son went to school in the morning and he never came back. We looked for him everywhere for 10 days. It didn't even cross our minds that he'd go up to the mountains. Later we learned from his friend that he was taken by the PKK. He was definitely tricked. My son could not have gone on his own will. He didn't have such love for them. I am sure he was tricked. At night, he couldn't even go to bed alone. He was afraid of the dark. We don't want anything from the PKK. We only want our children. We want our life back. We want our right to live.
The families claim their children have been held in mountainous PKK bases just across the nearby border in Iraqi Kurdistan. Throughout the three-decade conflict, thousands of young Kurdish men and women have gone to the mountains, a euphemism for joining the PKK. Until now, there have been few voices claiming any were kidnapped. But the Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has stepped in and taken up the family's cause. The dispute comes at a delicate time with the government-initiated peace process with the rebel group. According to Fatma Öncü, a member of the ruling AK Party's National Committee from Diyarbakir, the peace process has allowed people to start speaking out against the PKK.
This is a cry and a call brought forward by the peace initiative. Now there is peace and less pressure from the PKK. Women are now coming out onto the streets and voicing that their children are being kept in this way by the PKK. As a party, we are supporting these women in this process in every way. So their voices will become louder with the hope that this will prevent the youth of the region from going up the mountains.
At the vigil, such support is welcomed by the mothers, like Hatice. Both her daughters, she claims, were taken by the PKK.
My two daughters, they disappeared within 5 days of each other, one from the city of Sivas, the other from Samsun, where they were studying. After my youngest daughter disappeared, I went to Sivas. Her roommates told us that she and two other friends had disappeared together. Those two had left a note to their families saying, "We're going up the mountain. Don't worry about us. We will be much happier there." But my youngest daughter didn't leave a note. My older one probably followed her sister after hearing something about her. Perhaps she was threatened. I haven't heard anything from either of them. It's been almost 45 days. I saw the mother's protest on TV, and so I came here.
But the PKK, along with many pro-Kurdish political groups, have dismissed claims of abduction. Anthropologist Nurkit Seerman of Istanbul's Bosphorus University spent many months living in the predominantly Kurdish region. She says such is the politicization of Kurds because of decades of conflict, there are no shortage of willing volunteers, especially among young women, seeking to escape feudal life characterized by arranged and underage marriages.
There are a number of different reasons for that. I mean, one of which is, of course, their imprisoned leader, Abdullah Öcalan, has written widely on women's issues, and he talks about killing masculinity in his writings, and he has accepted that women have been dominated by many different structures, both what he calls feudalism. So he sees women as a kind of dominated group within the dominated group that can really sort of have revolutionary potential, that can really bring about change.
Pro-Kurdish political groups accuse the government of provoking the controversy as a distraction over the lack of progress in the peace process, which currently remains stalled. But while claims of abduction are dismissed out of hand, the controversy has raised an important issue, the use by the PKK of underage fighters. According to Edip Yaşar of the Democratic Society Congress, a pro-Kurdish movement.
In the 30-year conflict, there have been no accusations of kidnapping, but the PKK has stated that it has committed itself to the Geneva Convention and that no child under 16 will be given positions in the armed structure, and only those over 18 are given a weapon. The PKK has many civic programs which children can participate in, and the PKK said it will send back the children who want to go back home.
Back at the family's vigil, the PKK offer is being met with both skepticism and guarded optimism, according to Tokla.
These mothers are determined. They won't be going anywhere until their children come back. My son is 14 years old. What could he do at age 14? He wasn't even able to make such a big decision. Why are they taking our children like this? Even if the kid says, "I want to come," they shouldn't take him. God willing, he'll be sent back. We're waiting. We'll see.
No date has been given by the PKK to return any of the children. But observers point out the families could well be pawns in a wider struggle between the government and the pro-Kurdish movement over the current stalled peace process.
Dorian Jones reporting from Diyarbakir in Turkey there. Yasmin Chowdhury is a British Bangladeshi. As she writes on her website, she's on a mission to solve a big social problem, to change how the world experiences the world's least developed countries, starting with her parents' home country of Bangladesh.
To this end, in 2009, she started to put together ideas which would eventually result in her company Lovedesh and a foundation. She uses design, travel and food to try and bypass the traditional aid routes and get money directly into the pockets of the people she works with. In November, she'll be leading a second guided tour to Bangladesh, an experience which already won her a tourism award this year. We started by asking her how the idea for Lovedesh evolved.
A long, painful one, but a good one. It actually started, I'd probably say, stems from my father's death in 2004. He died unexpectedly. And I found myself over the years out of work as well. And being a single mother, I think one of the things I started to do was look towards him and his relationship with Bangladesh, funnily enough. And Love Desh actually was born out of trying to put right some of the things I didn't end up doing for him. So he'd actually always asked me, could you help out? You know, we've got you educated, so why don't you come out to Bangladesh and get involved in the philanthropic projects? And I'd always said no. So it was out of that, actually, after his death, Love Desh, in a way, is my little gift to him.
You say on your website, Yasmin, that it makes you sad that most of the stories we hear in the West about the so-called third world or developing world are one-sided ones, sort of gloom and doom, and they actually put us off travelling there. What are people in the West who are avoiding these countries missing out on, in your opinion?
They're missing out on one of the last vestiges places in the world where you can have a beautiful, serendipitous, authentic experience. I have that every time I go to somewhere like Bangladesh. And that's what I want to share and just help people share that with me. Because you don't leap out of bed wanting to go on a holiday in one of these places. Before I do that, though, it's recognizing the fear. It's smashing the stigma. It's trying to actually get away from that poverty porn. And don't get me wrong, it's very important we do hear about all the challenges and the struggles. But we just never get to hear the good stuff. And that was the problem I've started to solve, hopefully with Love Desh.
You grew up in Britain. What was your childhood like and how much contact did you have with Bangladesh back then?
I did have, I'd say, forced contact. My father always insisted. And at the time, I never believed him. He said, one day, my girl, you'll be grateful. But he would drag us out. And my first earliest memory was when I was 7 or 8. He suddenly announced that we were going to go and settle in Bangladesh, and I was mortified. So my first initial reaction was awful. I'd go out there and I realised that I had a very painful and difficult relationship with Bangladesh. I hated it. And I hated it only because I was presented to a society, looking back, it's almost like Jane Austen land without the fun, without any of the dances. And it's a very orthodox community. And I'd be, you know, told how to behave, where I could go, and we were often always chaperoned. So a very, very awful, I'd say, quite truthfully, awful experience growing up.
So eventually you stopped going with your father and he tended to go back on his own for a while when you'd grown up. So how did he feel about the country he left? You said that he was trying to go back there to settle. Was that his eventual hope?
I've understood my father a lot more now. I always felt, and I realised now, he felt terribly guilty. He'd made it. He was one of 8 brothers, and I guess he spent the rest of his life almost trying to assuage that guilt he had of, look, I made it, I left others behind, so I've got to go back and do something about it. And he'd always say, I want to settle. But his biggest dream was getting one of us, his children, to go out there. And I guess we just didn't. So he ended up going out there alone, and that's how I stumbled across all his projects after his death. And that's what inspired me to start working on Love Desh.
And you're also trying to bring about, in a way, sort of more of a direct help, putting money in the pockets of the people that are actually working with you, rather than kind of advocating this sort of relationship from the West where governments sort of work on international aid that goes to certain projects but maybe doesn't reach the people that you manage to reach.
Everything I do is actually dictated by listening to the folks on the ground. And I think they were shocked as well when I turned around and, you know, having visited them and trying to find out how can I best serve my father's memory and, you know, do some good at last. They'd say to me, nobody asks us. Gosh, really? You want to know what we want? And what it is they want is engagement. And they said, talk to us. You know, we want people to visit us. The only people who do visit Bangladesh, and I've seen them. are engineers, diplomats, you know, buyers, who do stay held up to some extent in their five-star hotels and then go back and say, oh, I had an awful experience. So these pennies to the pockets, the local folks, I'm very, very passionate about. And, you know, while I've been out to Bangladesh, I've been looking at microfinance projects and, you know, there's slowly as time wears on, I'm getting rather anxious because there is a whole millions. I mean, Bangladesh is 160 million people. And the folks that I meet are very destitute. But to help them, we need to engage with them and walk alongside them. And I think travel, a lot of funded projects where you seed fund them directly, that's what we're talking about. So it dignifies the act of giving. It helps to smash that stigma. And you know what? It's beneficial for both parties. That's what I think there isn't enough of.
Yasmin, could you perhaps describe what a typical Lovedesh tour to Bangladesh would look like for a tourist who decided to join you?
I've actually, because I do these tours to fund my philanthropic work, and Lovedesh is completely self-funded by me, so it's my dream and passion. But I realise, again, addressing the anxiety and fear, a lot of people want to be escorted. They need their hands held. So, for example, I think, you know, we've got what I've created is called the Lovedesh Voyage. And I call ourselves, you know, Third World Scouts or the Lovedesh Scout, because what I do is go in there and put my Western hat on and say, right, what is there about Bangladesh that I know will grab people and make them jump out of their seat and say, I want that. So we're doing a 13-day visit to Bangladesh in November, and we'll be doing a lot more. But it's taking in all the highlights and all the characters. Now, by characters, you know, it's got the largest mangrove forest, but I'll tell you who the character is there. The guys who take you to actually enter the forest, they're like almost like actors in the making, because they spend all their time guiding people. But the minute you give them airtime, my God, the stories they come out with. So it's that, it's cycling, it's a little cruise, it's cooking with the local women, it's giggling with them, it's going and jumping in the river, going foraging. All these things I've woven because those are the best experiences I personally had and I made happen when I was out in Bangladesh. So, yeah, I hope that kind of like gives a flavour of how Bangladesh is a beautiful destination if you look at it and do it the right way with the right people.
Yasmin Chowdhury talking to us from London there. And if you want to find out more about her work or the tour, you can go to her website, www.lovedesh.com.
During its war with the United States, North Vietnam wasn't just concerned with how the frontline battles were going or the US air raids on the capital city. The communist leaders were also worried about what its citizens were singing. The government only wanted songs that encouraged people to fight for the nation. Most other music was banned, especially love songs.
That's how a young musician named Nguyen Phan Loc ended up spending a decade in prison. Christopher Johnson visited the 69-year-old artist at his cafe in Hanoi. Here's his story.
Nguyen Phan Loc still remembers the song that got him in trouble.
Dù có gió có giá lạnh đầy, có tuyết bùn lầy, có lá buồn gầy.
When he was put on trial, Nguyen was accused of singing this classic as a statement against the government. But this isn't rebel music, Nguyen insists. It's not a call for revolution.
Tức là nó chỉ cái nội dung trong cái đó thì là giữa hai người tình yêu với nhau.
It's about love. It's about the last reunion between a man and a woman. Before the man has to leave to go far away. It's about the last night they are together.
The song is from a style called Nhạc Chư Thành, which means romantic music. The songs are usually about love and loss and broken hearts, kind of like the blues. Most of it was written in the first half of the 20th century. As a young adult, Nguyen started a trio with two acoustic guitarists.
So during our free time, we gather in the room and we close the door and we sang to one another. And only a few close friends who really love this music, we allow them to join us and listen to us.
They had good reason to keep their music a secret. This was the late 1960s. North Vietnam's war with U.S. and South Vietnamese forces was intensifying. The communist authority wanted its citizens' minds on victory, not the heartache of romance tunes. And there was another problem. The music was huge in South Vietnam. Songs like Suoi Mơ or Spring Stream filled Saigon's bars, packed with cigarette smoke and American GIs looking for a good time. This music was like a soundtrack for the war effort. So the North officially outlawed most of it as the sound of the anti-communist enemy.
We knew that the state had banned the music, but we just didn't care. We had no political agenda.
Somehow the police found out about the group's clandestine concerts. For a month, they got called in for questioning. And in the spring of 1968, Nguyen headed down to the station on what he thought was another routine summons. He was 23 years old, a house painter who'd just fallen in love with a girl he met at one of the shows. He wouldn't see her again for 10 years.
I was arrested under the charges of suspicion of spreading the depraved culture of capitalism and destroying the culture of socialism. And then they took me back home so they could search my house. But they found nothing but old lyrics and sheet music. That's all.
The whole group was sent to prison. One bandmate got 15 years. Nguyen Van Loke did hard labor, serving out some of his time at the notorious Hanoi Hilton. Nguyen Thuy Ca is a music journalist and historian, as well as a composer. He fought in the war with the Red Army. Even as an artist today, he says the wartime ban was necessary.
Lost the war. That's what would have happened if we had kept singing those gloomy, weak songs. Meanwhile, we're living under U.S. bombardment and air attacks. We would just be embracing one another and crying out to die if we sang that music. We couldn't do that.
Today, Vietnam actually celebrates its old-school romantic music as part of the national heritage. This is like a slap in the face for Nguyen Van Loke. Both of his bandmates died in poverty after they got out. Over the last 3.5 decades, Nguyen has struggled a lot, too. Mostly, he says, because of his criminal record. Still, he does not apologize for his choices.
There's no regret. If I had regretted it, I would not be here today, still singing.
And Nguyen's story isn't all about loss. The young woman he fell in love with before he was sentenced, they got married and had 2 kids before she died in 2002. He's also got this cafe that looks out onto the south side of Hanoi's biggest lake. He's dedicated the space to Vietnam's golden music. Nguyen and his band sing the classics for a well-dressed crowd, mostly older, but not entirely. Dinh Van Thien is a 30-year-old engineer who's brought his girlfriend here for the first time. Most of their friends go for pop or rap, but Thien says he'll take Nguyen's cafe over a night at the club. This music is emotional, and it has deep feeling. Listening to Nhạc Trữ Thanh, Thien says, you're like a foreigner. You come here, and through the music, you can learn about Hanoi and Vietnam.
Vietnam's answer to the blues, ending that report by Christopher Johnson, and indeed bringing us to the end of this week's program.
We hope you enjoyed it and will be joining us again next week for more personal stories from around the globe. WorldLink was produced by Claudia Rack, Emma Wallace and Neil King. And as always, if you'd like to hear any of the items featured on today's programme again, just go to dw.de/WorldLink or look us up on iTunes. WorldLink is brought to you by DW in Bonn.